I'm Anita Lustria, and this is Faith Conversations. Today on the podcast, I'm delighted to have Kara Meredith with me, and you're going to hear parts of her story. I'm going to really encourage you to get her book, The Color of Life, but let me just say a couple of quick things before we really get into Kara's story. First of all, I am so delighted. I've had a couple of people sign on to support the podcast through Patreon. And I know I don't say this all that often, but Patreon is this little icon at the bottom of the homepage at AnitaLustria.com. It's a little P. No, it's not Pinterest. It's a different P, Patreon. And you can sign on and, you know, give a value to the podcast, a buck an episode or whatever, 50 cents an episode, $10 an episode. Yes, I know. But anyway, that gives you an opportunity to support this. Also, I just heard from Denise, who said, wow, your conversation with Dominique Gilliard regarding his book, Rethinking Incarceration, Advocating for Justice That Restores, was a real eye-opener. Thank you for having him on the podcast. If you've not heard that one, you want to go back and take a listen. Denise goes on to say, I was listening to it while driving to work, and I was so mad at myself for not being able to write things down because he made so many great comments. And so much that I need to contemplate. Thanks for such a great podcast. Faith Conversations is in the top five of my favorite podcasts. Well, that made my day. I got to ask her what the other ones are in her top five. So I love hearing from people. It's so encouraging. And you can email anytime, producer@AnitaLustria.com. And I would love to hear from you. Thank you. All right, let's get to it. Kara Meredith is on the podcast with me today. She's a writer and a speaker. I'm also sitting here realizing I don't have my glasses on. No wonder I'm holding her book at arm's length and trying to read it. That's funny. So she is a writer and a speaker whose work has appeared in all kinds of publications, including some that you all know, Christianity Today, I Believe, and For Every Mom. She's a former high school English teacher and outreach ministry director, and she holds a master of theology from Fuller Seminary. She and her husband and two sons live in the San Francisco Bay Area. Kara, welcome to Faith Conversations.
Thank you, Anita. I'm so excited to be here.
Well, I'm delighted to have you for a couple of reasons. One, I really appreciate what you've written on. I mean, this is The Color of Life, the name of your book, subtitled A Journey Toward Love and Racial Justice. It's really a memoir, isn't it? That's the genre that you're writing in. And I personally love the memoir genre because I think you can say so much within that genre, and it gives a window into the writer's soul, and I love all of that. But let's get to it. You're a woman who was raised in Oregon, right?
I'll
ask you, suburbia? Was it, you know, or urbia?
Absolutely, yeah. I was raised in the Willamette Valley, which is kind of the area just south of Portland. So it's along the I-5 corridor, if your listener ever taken a road trip through the Pacific Northwest. But raised in the Willamette Valley and raised in a predominantly white suburban environment. And a lot of the world that I came from, I love Oregon. I love the Pacific Northwest. We're heading up there in 3 weeks for spring break.
Yay.
But a lot of the world I grew up in was, when it comes to issues of justice, race, and privilege, was very white. And, in that way, there was almost a colorblind rhetoric, that we didn't necessarily think that issues of race had anything to do with us. And that existed both in the church and in schools. And so, that was kind of my world, was just thinking, well, I am white or of European American descent, and therefore this doesn't really have anything to do with me.
Enter, you know, this is years down the road. You know, you go off to college, you start your working life, etc. Had not found Mr. Right yet. Enter eHarmony, or something, some kind of online something or other.
Z Harmony, Dr. Neil Clark Warren.
There you go. And he's happy to have that credit too. That's great. And you connect online and then eventually in person with who you're eventually going to marry, James Meredith.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I started reading your book and I ran into my husband and I go, you're not going to believe this book I'm reading. Mm-hmm. And who, Kara Meredith, who, you know, who she marries, the memoir writer. And anyway, and he started telling me all kinds of things. But for the sake of readers, and also because this is a piece of your story, you didn't necessarily know who it was that you had connected with in the online dating arena. You knew you liked
Absolutely.
Him, but you didn't know who he was necessarily.
Yeah, no, I was drawn to him. I mean, we did not close communication. And obviously we then, we opened up communication to meeting each other face to face. But I write about this in our book, but on our third date, we were at his place and we sat down in his living room and the music was playing and, the wine was flowing, if I'm allowed to say that on your podcast.
Oh, yeah.
And, okay. And we were already smitten with one another. And he brings over to me this stack of photography books, and not just the scrapbook like I used to create in the late 90s, but he brings over these legitimate historical photography books, and he places them on the coffee table before me. And he opens them up to a couple of earmarked pages. And he says, hey, I want to show you something. And as he opens the picture up, he points to a picture of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And he says, this is my dad.
This is great.
And
I love this.
And I look at him and I go, Martin Luther King is your dad? And he goes, no, this is dad. And he points to the man walking next to him. And it was a picture of a man named James Meredith, who was the first African-American man to integrate into the University of Mississippi in 1962. And then 4 years later, in this scene with Dr. King, he led the Meredith March Against Fear, which essentially was intended to be a one-man solitary march through the state of Mississippi against the fear that a lot of African-American or Black voters still had. On the second day, he was shot by a white supremacist. And he still lived. He's still alive today. But after being shot, that's when Dr. King, Stokely Carmichael, and a number of leading members from the civil rights movement, from the SLCC, came together and began to march for him. Mm. So that picture that my then husband showed me was a picture near the very end of what became the last greatest march of the civil rights movement, and essentially King and Carmichael and all these other mostly men came alongside and walked with my father-in-law. But I didn't know, I mean, this is part of your point, I didn't know who he was. And I sat there, I was 30 years old, and I went, wow, I'm feeling equal parts awe and shame, because I'm sure that I probably learned about him as a 16-year-old sitting in AP US history. I'm sure I learned about him as a college student. I was an education undergrad. And so I'm sure I learned about him in some sort of education major or in education class. And yet all of that information went in one ear and not the other, because it was my advantage not to know and not to have to remember.
I appreciate that. And I have to say, you know, I am, I don't know, probably 20 years your senior or something like that. So
you'll look good, Anita.
Well,
you'll look good.
There you go. Well, listen, at your age, as you were learning this information about your future husband's father, I would have been right there in the same boat. So I have felt that, and we're probably talking to people today listening to the podcast that are even feeling it as they hear this and go, oh, I did not know that name.
Yeah.
This is why I really believe that your memoir is important on a number of fronts. But I think you engage the conversation in a beautiful way, and in a way that is trying to set shame to the side, and yet say, and yet this is an extremely important conversation, and so let's have it, and let us see it through my eyes as I learned some of these things, as I engaged with this man that eventually would be my husband. I want to go back to say that your father-in-law, James Howard Meredith, wrote the foreword to your book, which, how lovely is that? But one of the questions that he states in the foreword And he says, to me, it has always been a simple question. Who in America enjoys the rights of full citizenship? And I remember hearing my husband, I don't even know what setting we were in, but somewhere, maybe a baseball game or whatever, singing the national anthem, getting to the end, mm-hmm. you know, the home, land of the free and the home of the brave, and hearing him blurt out, and may it be so, Lord. You know, and may it be so. And I turned and I said, what's that? What's, you know, and we, of course, had this conversation that it is not necessarily so for many Americans, many people of color who are American citizens. And so as your father-in-law poses this question, who in America enjoys the rights of full citizenship? Some people might say, ooh, that's a loaded question. Well, for who? You know, is that a loaded question? So I would love for you to go on, because I can get kind of charged up here. And but you have written so beautifully and kindly, and yet about very hard things. Because these were things you were learning as you went along. So I want to go back to why was it important for you to write this memoir, The Color of Life?
Absolutely. You know, it's actually a question that I end up answering at the very end of the book.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Because
I've not gotten there yet.
It's okay. I was trying not to out you in that way, but you just said it. So then we can say
it. That's right.
So yes, Anita, please finish reading when you get the chance.
I will.
One of the questions that my father-in-law continued to ask me on one of my trips out there, I took a trip right after I signed a book contract, and I said to my husband, I need to go out to Mississippi. I need to visit the family. I need to spend time with your dad, and I need to do this by myself. And he said, all right.
I love that tone.
Nobody went with me. Neither my sons nor my husband came with me. And I had the pleasure of spending 4 days with the extended family, mostly with my father-in-law. And I didn't know what to expect. He and I had never hung out just one-on-one, minus maybe 10 minutes here and there. And yet he completely cleared his schedule to just be mine over the course of a weekend, of a long weekend. And so we went and we traveled throughout the greater Jackson area, Jackson, Mississippi, and went to all these sites throughout the city.
And let me just interject that you were spending time with your husband's father. His mother passed away when he was still in high school or middle school, maybe 14, 15, somewhere in that range.
Yeah, his birth mother died when he and his twin brother were 12.
Okay.
James Sr. then remarried married a woman named Judy, who for all intents and purposes is my mother-in-law, even though we don't my husband does not share a birth line. So
yes.
Judy and James are still reigning supreme in Jackson.
Love it.
So that weekend, James Sr. dropped everything just to hang out with me. We went to the state capitol. We went to Togo College. We went to Chick-fil-A. Not that that had any historical significance, but we went there anyway. And throughout this time, he asked me the question. He said, why are you writing this book? And I write my book. I said, because people are fascinated about the journey of a white woman who married your son. He shook his head. Why are you writing this book? Because I have a story to tell, I said, because white people need to understand that issues of race have something to do with them, because stories of interracial marriage and biracial children are few and far between. He shook his fists in the air, frustrated by my response. Why are you writing this book? Because I want justice for my black and brown brothers and sisters, I said, exasperated. And I gave every answer, and it wasn't until I returned home, we were living in Seattle at the time, that I finally understood why I was writing this book. I was writing this book because I needed to understand and realize that wholeness and justice were for me. I was writing it for me.
Yeah.
Realizing that wholeness and justice, and therefore redemption, is for me, is every single one of us, then what that does is it makes me want to take my power and my privilege or whatever you want to say and lay it down so that the voices of those I've silenced the voices of those who have been silenced and marginalized would be lifted up. So when I realize that the wholeness is mine, then I can't help but want it for everybody. So that's when I'm asked, why did you write this book? Well, sure, it was a great idea. Sure. My agent thought, hey, you had a post go viral and people probably want to read this. Sure, all of those things that I listed off, but even more, I wrote it for my own racial healing and wholeness to realize that this was mine. But then to lay it down, because I think that's who Christ is and that's what we're called to do, right?
Yeah.
Philippians 2, you know?
Yeah, I'm soaking it in. I'm soaking that in because I think that's big, because I think that same thing could be asked, you know, why do anyone who is white, why do we want to engage in this conversation? And I think in the end, it's exactly what you're talking about. It takes us a while to get there and to figure
Absolutely.
Out that that's the bigger issue and the reason. You know, I think one of the things I appreciate that you write about, and I think why this is such a good read as well, is for any, and I would say, well, and I should ask you this, who is your audience? But I'm assuming mm-hmm. predominantly a white audience, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, the first audience for any writer out there, that's your first question. Who are you writing this for? And so the first defined audience, we said the first audience is a white audience that doesn't think issues of race have anything to do with them. That being said, we were very purposeful, both me, myself, and I, but also the publishing team, in making sure that we had readers and editors of color at every level along the way. There are a number of folks who identify as people of color who are reading the book. There's a lot of people who are interested in the historical side of my father-in-law,
sure.
and obviously he stars in the story quite a bit,
yes.
as does my husband, as do later on my children. But with that, there are a lot of readers of color, but it was one of those that we wanted to identify the first audience. And so that was also, you've talked a little bit about the book being very story driven, mm-hmm. and that was also very purposeful. You know, Dominique Gilliard, whom you just had on, I mean, he's a brilliant man. My hope is that my storytelling will envelop and bring in readers who will then pick up Dominique's book, mm-hmm. who will then pick up, you know, the books like his, like Michelle Alexander's, The New Jim Crow,
right.
which is kind of the secular version, so to speak, of his book, who will then pick up books about justice and healing in the church from Dr. Brenda Salter McNeil, from Lisa Sharon Harper, from Soon Chang Ra, from voices of color who are leading the charge, whom a lot of us haven't always been listening to. So in that way, we approached it, and this took a lot of work. We purposefully approached it with me not being an expert, but instead being a fellow sojourner,
yes.
and telling it in
that.
Story form.
Love that.
And so that's where there are some chapters that I joke with my agent. I said I've written this chapter 30 times, and at one point I did write that to her over an email, and she wrote back and said, "Go for 31." You know, and I was like, "Come on!"
Yes.
But what does it mean to enter into story?
Yeah.
And to realize then that the story is all of ours, but also to say, I'm not an expert in this, and I don't need to pretend like I am. I'm a fellow sojourner. My role is to listen and learn and listen some more. And I do acknowledge and realize that I have a story to tell, and so I communicate that story. But I also communicate that story as a learner, and because mine is a learning experience. It's not a lived experience. It's a lived experience when it comes to interracial marriage, when it comes to raising biracial kids. But when it comes to obviously actually being a person of color and the oppression and hate that can come with that, that is not a lived experience.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I've got to believe hard to write to just some of those things where you feel like, oh, I hate that I even have to write this or say that I didn't know this or didn't understand this or what, all that stuff, which you've kind of alluded to as well. And so thank you for that, because I think you are speaking a lot of people's stories in that sense. One of the things I wanted to talk about and have you talk a bit about as well is the relationship, how you navigated some of these racial issues with your parents as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what transpired when you said, hey, I'm bringing home who I think is the guy, and your parents met James for the first time?
Absolutely. You know, it's, I was telling someone on another radio show the other day that, that honestly, a lot of our initial conversations were very easy. I'm the oldest child. I was the last to get married.
Okay.
So by the time I met James, you know, they're just sitting there going, oh, praise little baby Jesus. our daughter finally found someone. You know, my mom
to take her off our hands.
Yes. And so they were smitten with James from the beginning, and truly, even though there was a big question in both of our minds, because I would be the first white person to marry into the Meredith family, he would be the first black person to marry into my family, that was a question that we held. Honestly, a lot of the harder conversations came later.
Okay.
So that was one of those that I love my parents, and we still are in relationship. And sometimes we don't always talk about some of those hard questions. Mm-hmm. They gave me permission to say whatever I wanted to say. But one scene with my father later on in the book that was really hard for both of us was talking about privilege. Mm. Because my father, who was a white man, he never felt like privilege was his. Mm. And privilege can be a scary word for us to use too. So whether we say that, whether we maybe more so say advantage, he did not feel like the advantages that could have been given to him had been given to him. And so there's a scene later on in the book where he and I are sitting down across from a Starbucks table with one another. And I had interviewed almost 50 people for my book, family members, but also just a wide range of speakers and authors and individuals that I knew had a story to tell. And so I asked my dad the same questions that I had asked everyone else, but I was nervous and I was scared. So a couple of the questions I said, so Dad, how do we solve the issues of race and privilege in America today? God is the only way forward, he said, a new boldness about him. Right now, I am reading the Bible in a year. I am absolutely amazed because I've never done this before. I've never read the Bible entirely through, but I am amazed at how patient God was with the Israelites, how he was always willing to help them when they cried out to him. God has infinite patience. He's used it on me, and he used it on all of us. So the least I can do is be as patient as I can. Even in matters of race and privilege, when you don't agree with what I'm saying, I asked. Maybe, but that might be taking it too far. Hmm. Agreed. Are we done here? He asked, tiredness overcoming him. This was not the easiest conversation, not for him and not for me, but we were entering into dialogue nonetheless. Understanding one another, maybe for the first time in a long time.
Read that last sentence again. It cut out, and I want people to hear that.
Oh, sure. Said this was not the easiest conversation, not for him and not for me, but we were entering into dialogue nonetheless. We were practicing patience, seeking understanding with one another, maybe for the first time in a long time.
Seeking understanding with one another, maybe for the first time in a long time. Wow. Baby steps, right? Little, you know, I think one of the things that you model in your writing, and well, because it's real life, because it's a memoir, is keeping in the conversation, knowing when to press, when to not, when to ask, mm-hmm. when to, you know, table the conversation. And I think that's a tricky thing and a difficult thing. How has it been? You know, it's one thing for you to be patient with your parents. How, you know, how is James? Sure. interacted or been with your parents. Of course, he loves you, and so my guess is he's probably pretty patient with them as well.
Absolutely. You know, there was an article that ran a book review right after The Color of Life released by Inglewood Review of Books, and I'll try to send it to you so you can also put it along to your listeners.
Thank you.
The reviewer ended by saying, one thing that is unspoken that I think all of us have to notice is how patient James, as in Kara's husband, was the entire time throughout this story of her journey, of her eyes being opened. And he then, the reviewer then wrote, and what does that mean for us in the church? Mm. What does that mean for those of us who are still catching up? What does it mean to continue to show infinite patience? So, yes, that's characteristic of my husband, both with me and with my parents and with everyone. I think that's where we choose love. That is where we choose to honor the Imago Dei in one another, the image of God, even if we don't always agree. And sometimes that means having the conversation. And sometimes, like you just said, it means not having the conversation. But whatever and however that looks like, it means, again, that we're choosing love. And that's been one of the taglines of the book. We say it was the power of love that helped me see color. Mm. And so what does it mean to continue to err on the side of love? Mm. I mean, that's Jesus. That's Dr. King. That, you know, all the great people who figured it out long before we did.
Right.
Love,
on.
Love, 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 love.
So. Yeah. Isn't that the truth? I want to move forward. I think, you know, before we end today, I certainly want to ask a little bit about what people in the church can do, followers of Christ, wherever they find themselves, to address some of the issues that are transpiring. I mean, how maybe even some concrete things. But I want to ask about some of the challenges of interracial marriage as well.
Sure.
You know, you address that. And how have you and James dealt with some of those challenges? And some of those are, I would, you know, internal and external, maybe more so external, I don't know.
Sure, it's a little bit of everything. You know, I think I went into marriage, obviously wholly smitten with the man. Otherwise,
yes.
I wouldn't have said yes. Smitten, it's such an archaic, fantastic word. Not as smitten archaic as I think, but...
And let me say this. I read somewhere, I think, that where you call yourself a cup three quarters full person. Is that?
Absolutely.
And I loved that.
I am an optimist to the bone.
Yes. I have a son that's like that. So I love that you said that about yourself.
And he would err on the other side.
Okay.
So that can always be, the yin yang of the two of us. But honestly, it wasn't until, I think especially throughout our dating and engagement period, I was in love with who we were on the outside.
Sure.
And I thought,
sure.
Man, our black and white selves are somehow going to just break down walls in the church and in life, and our love is going to conquer the world. And didn't necessarily understand how our racial differences would play a role in our marriage. Mm. Instead, I thought, I'm an optimist. He maybe leans toward pessimism a little bit. I'm an extrovert. He's an introvert. I'm a woman. He's a man. And I let that be more so the differences. And so there's been a big part of learning for me has been learning what it means to enter into interracial marriage. And I do write about this quite a bit in the book. I write about it historically in looking and learning from Loving v. Virginia, which was a 12-year court case in the United States that didn't resolve until 1967, that allowed for interracial marriage in the U.S., which that's pretty recent, you know?
Yeah.
But then also in seeing, okay, when it comes to our differences, I have to understand that our racial differences do play a part in our marriage, and especially that some of the pain that he has experienced as a Black man, that that is going to be something that I am also marrying into. So in that way, that's something that we've had to learn about. In a chapter titled Differences, I write about a scene with a therapist, and she said, "You're brave to choose an interracial marriage." And I remember looking at her and just balking, going, "What? What are you talking about? Brave? Surely this has nothing to do with bravery. This has everything to do with falling in love and marrying a man whose skin happens to be darker than my own." I looked at her and layered. Her words were not helpful in that moment, not for my heart, and certainly not for your marriage. It takes bravery to admit that the differences of your experiences and stories, especially when it comes to issues of race and ethnicity, and it takes bravery to face those differences head on, especially in a marriage. Mm. And I remember looking at that and just going, okay, that's right. This is part of it. Mm. And I think, I mean, interracial marriage in the U.S. is on the rise. And mm-hmm. We can look at the statistics. 14% of whites, Hispanic, and Asians still say that they would oppose a marriage. But when it comes to the numbers, in the state of California, for instance, almost 25% of marriages are interracial.
Wow.
Across the U.S., I think I have the numbers in the back, but I think it's something like 14 or 16% of marriages are interracial. And so what that also means for the next generation, for children, when we read stories or see articles about the United States becoming a minority majority, that's where a lot of this is coming from, because those mixed race children will the numbers predicted by 2050 that we will be a minority majority.
Yeah. Yeah, that's, and I think that's probably why the conversation is intensifying, don't you think?
Mm-hmm.
Or one reason.
Absolutely.
One reason. Yeah. How important was it to the two of you, and I don't know if you talk about this, to find some other couples that you fully identified with, some other interracial couples?
Absolutely. It was fully important. That was a huge part of my journey also, was learning to notice who was sitting at our table and not sitting at our table. And I think that's something for all of us, no matter whether we're in an interracial marriage. But it's looking and saying, it's beginning to notice. And it's saying, okay, who's in my friend group? Because statistically speaking, 75% of white people only are hanging out with people who look like them. But it's also a matter of looking at our bookshelves. It's looking at the voices of the podcast that we listen to. Who is filling the rhetoric of the world around us and taking steps forward? So for us, that did mean beginning to invite with intentionality other couples, because it was a matter of having people who both of the representation, but also of the shared experience, that other people could speak to what that was.
Mm. Let's talk about your sons. How old are they now?
They're 6 and 4.
Oh, great ages.
So they're still precious. And like I told you earlier, one of them is at home with me. The Oakland Public Schools are on strike. Mm. The teachers are, excuse me, not the district.
Yes.
Okay. And so he is upstairs still being quiet, which is the stuff miracles are made of. But yeah, so they're still young. They're the loves of our lives.
How do you deal with, well, I think it's amazing to me what strangers will come up to parents mm-hmm. or people and blurt out, honestly. It's still, you know, it's one thing. Yeah, it's just kind of shocking.
Yeah.
Talk about some mm-hmm. of what has been blurted out to you as you, a white woman, have been shopping or wherever with your two little sons who are mixed race. And talk about how do you walk through that? How do you and your husband deal with that with others, and also in front of your dear children? Because this is an issue mm-hmm. that they are living with, will live with the rest of their lives. Albeit, as you talked about that statistic, they will, you know, they're going to grow up and be around when mm-hmm. they become the majority, which will hopefully will shift things and change things in their lives. But right now, talk about what it has looked like.
Absolutely. You know, we don't shy away from conversations of race and justice with our kids. I oftentimes say that my older son, he's got, I mean, both of them, they have justice in their bones. But my older son, I mean, he is fascinated by his father, by his grandfather, by Dr. King, by other leaders. And he will sit there and pore over the history books. And I just go, well, first of all, you're already smarter than I am. And second of all, let's just keep up. Let's up this fascination and this nerdiness, because I love that about you.
Can I ask this question before you go mm-hmm. on with that?
Sure.
You just said age 4 and age 6. So it's my mm-hmm. belief that we do not start talking to our children nearly young enough. I'm listening to what you're doing with your kids. Mm-hmm. I think these are conversations that need to be, that we need to have with our children, no matter what race. We need to start engaging in these kinds of conversations way earlier than we ever do. And again, that goes back to privilege. I understand that too. But
absolutely. There's a study that I, in my book, but from a book, Nurture Shock, 75, non-white parents are 3 times more likely to enter into conversations of race, while 75% of white parents never or almost never talk about race. So part of this does have to do with it being an advantage to not necessarily feel like you have to talk about race. But we sit here and we go, this is real. So yes, we have to talk about this with our kids, but this should be something that is talked about with every single one of our children, no matter the color of their skin. When it comes back to the earlier question, what you were talking about, first of all, I think we first started talking about race when our boys were probably 2. Mm. And most of that had to do with their leading. That's when we initially noticed them noticing. Mm. I remember one poignant scene. My older son was 2 years old, and I remember him looking at a picture on the television screen. The radio was playing in the background, and so it would show the artist. And his Nana, Judy, was in the room, and Judy is a light-skinned African-American woman. And so a picture came on, and it was a picture of Bruno Mars mm-hmm. singing, and then Bruno Mars was singing the song in the background, and he pointed to Bruno Mars, and he said, Dada. And we were like, that's not Dada, that's Bruno Mars. And then a picture of Kelly Clarkson came on, and she started singing, and he pointed to the picture, and he said, Mama. And I remember looking at that going, wait a minute. And then, kid you not, a third picture came on, and Alicia Keys, who is a light-skinned African-American woman, came on, and he pointed, and he said, Nana. Nana.
Yeah.
And we looked at that, and we were like, oh, wow, our boy sees color. But honestly, studies show that as young as 6 months old, children are able to differentiate race and make racial biases or preferences.
Yeah, that was a shocker when I read that race. In your book. That, mm-hmm. Yeah, okay.
So for us, when it comes to raising our children, we are very aware. And there are several scenes in my book in which people say inappropriate things, asking if they are mine simply because my children have a different skin color than I do is not appropriate. Asking if I'm the nanny is not okay. There's a scene I write about when I was on a medication for arthritis for my back. And I ended up having an extreme reaction to the arthritis or to the medication, and had hives. Ugh. Hives were covering every inch of my body. My husband had to work late that day, and I call my doctor out of desperation, and I say, you need to get me something right now because I am in so much pain. So the doctor called in a prescription to the local pharmacy, and at 7 o'clock, which I don't know for the rest of your listeners what it looks like in your house, but 7 o'clock in our house is typically witching hour. The children kind of turn feral. We try to go to bed because it's not okay for them to continue to be up.
Yeah.
And this was a few years ago, but I was desperate for a remedy to the pain. And so I took the boys, we went down the street to the pharmacy, and boys, it was 7:15 at night. And so of course they're ready for bed. They're kind of entering into quasi hyperactive mode. And so we're standing in line, and they begin to play Ring Around the Rosie around a display sign. And most of the patrons in the store, because there was a queue, of all of us waiting, they kind of looked and laughed. They weren't knocking stuff off the shelves. Yeah. They weren't being out of control. And all of a sudden, this woman who was standing beside me, she steps out of line and she starts yelling at them. Mm-hmm. And she says, "Don't you know this is a store? Don't you know you're supposed to be quiet, that you're not allowed to act this way, that you shouldn't be running around a grocery store in the first place?" And everyone in the store just goes mute. She was not yelling at me. She was yelling at the boys. And I remember looking at her going, "Are you kidding me? Did this really just happen?" And it was one of those that I tried to get out of there as fast as I could. Yeah. And finally, wow. I take the boys, tears starting to stream down my face. Mm-hmm. And the boys, they were like, "Is she joking? What's going on?" And I say to her, I was like, "I'm not going to engage." Mm. But I finally said to her, "Have a nice day." Mm. Which, you know, I was like, "What would Jesus do?" But I say it with a little bit of snark and sass. And she yells back. She said, "Lady, just a reminder, you're getting a tax break for those things." And she was talking about my sons. Tears are streaming by this point.
Me? Oh, yeah. Oh, my.
And I just say to her, "You know what? I'm doing the best I can." And I remember thinking after that, I remember thinking, wow, well, that lady, that was not a very nice thing to do. And then I had a friend of mine who is a biracial woman. And she said to me as gently as she could, she said, "Kara, it sounds like you just encountered your first taste of racism." And I remember sitting there going, this couldn't be racism. This couldn't be about race. This was about my kids just playing ring around the Rosie in the store when they should have been sleeping. Mm. And she said, "You know what though?" She said, "In American culture, we don't often see black boys as boys, but we see them as men. Mm. We see them as what we think they're supposed to be." Ooh. And so the expectations become different for them. Ooh. And those boys, those young boys, don't get to be children. They become things and tax write-offs instead of 2 and 4-year-old boys who fancy a game at the grocery store. So for me, that was a huge learning moment. And for our boys, when it comes to the then and now, we don't shy away from this. We don't shy away from conversations. And part of that, we can't.
Right.
But we also just say, yes, this is true, that hate still exists. Mm. And yet we are going to respond with love. Mm-hmm. And we are, at the end of the day, we're all doing the best we can. Mm. But we're also not going to shy away from the reality of these stories.
Mm. Kara, I could go on and on. I know you've got some time constraints in your schedule, but I would just love to hear from you. What do you hope people walk away from The Color of Life with?
Absolutely. My hope is that sparks conversation. That's my greatest hope for the book. It has been an honor, mostly on the West Coast, but it's been an honor to enter into conversations with friends of color around my book. Mm. I've not wanted to do a traditional book tour where I stand up on stage and talk about race, because if I'm doing that by myself, then I'm kind of missing the picture. Mm-hmm. And my audience is therefore missing the picture. And so what we've been trying to do is partner with friends of color to have real and honest dialogue and conversations about issues that stem from my book.
Wonderful.
And to be brilliant. Able to model that to to the audience. And so we've had 4 conversational events so far, and it has been an honor to then, when everything finishes, to just look out and see people engaged in conversation.
That's fantastic.
And I say, if we can do that on a local level, if we can do that and begin to have the conversations that we have to have, because until we don't have to be having these conversations, we have to be having these conversations.
Right on. Yeah.
Then I've done my job.
Yeah.
And so in that way, I hope that this sparks big conversations.
I love it. It makes my little tagline, the line I end with each week, all the more important. So I'll say thank you to you so much for writing the book and for being with me today on Faith Conversations. And to everyone else, I say keep the conversation going.